Welcome to the Untold Tales audio anthologies. Written by Dr. Jeffrey A. Robinson and narrated by Melissa Del Toro Schaffner. Part 1. Those Who Watch. Ian MacDonald hurried from the public library, clutching a thick folder of research papers close to his chest. He scurried down the wide granite steps and glanced furtively in both directions to see if anyone was watching him. Anxiety washed over him as if his blood had suddenly become ice cold. Pulling up the collar of his frayed suit coat, he shivered involuntarily, despite the bright afternoon sun. "It's still too much to believe," thought Ian. "Even though my analysis of Dr. Henderson's data showed he was correct." Shaking his head in silent argument with his own results, he hurried along the sidewalk silently talking to himself. More than anything, he wanted to believe the correlations he had found were a fluke. The theory his old friend and mentor had proposed was patently absurd. A cold lump formed in Ian's chest. "It must be some kind of statistical coincidence," he thought. "His claims just can't be true." Nevertheless, Dr. Henson was dead, just as his final letters had predicted. Moreover, the bundle Ian carried, a photocopy of a rare 17th-century manuscript, still warm from the library copier, provided independent substantiation of all Henderson's claims. Not that such foreknowledge benefited Henderson, he thought. The hairs on the back of Ian's neck rose, and a nagging suspicion haunted him. With no reason to justify it, he had an unshakable certainty that someone was watching him. Not just looking in his direction, but staring at him, studying him intently. Ian halted abruptly in the middle of the sidewalk and spun around to look behind him. Passers-by, however, walked around him and ignored him with traditional New York aloofness. No one even glanced in his direction. No eyes paused on him as pedestrians strolled by. No one noticed him. No one followed. Holding his papers tighter against his chest, Ian turned back around and hurried down the sidewalk, fighting the urge to break into a run that would certainly attract attention. Across the street, in the park opposite the library, a small boy, no more than 5 or 6 years of age, laughed and played with his friends. Abruptly, he stopped his game of catch and turned his head in Ian's direction. Standing uncharacteristically still, the boy paused, his eyes tracking the progress of the nervous little scholar. The child did not blink, as his eyes followed the man along the street. Nor did the boy note the calls of his playmates to throw the ball he held calmly in his hands. For long seconds, the child remained immobile, moving nothing but his eyes. As Ian rounded a street corner and disappeared down an adjacent street, the boy blinked and turned once more to his friends who taunted him, demanding that he throw the ball back to them. With perfect innocence, he returned to his game, unaware that any time had passed at all. Ian continued down the next street, the tall gray granite buildings now blocking the sun and transforming Ian's imagined chill into a real one. Glancing to either side, he risked another quick look behind him. Seeing nothing out of the ordinary, he sighed and felt a little more secure. The urgency of his pace lessened, but that was only because he did not notice the little girl in an upstairs window who turned her attention from the nearby television and directed her gaze down at him. Oblivious to the slapstick antics of her favorite cartoon characters, the 6-year-old stared unblinkingly as the uneasy man in the worn brown suit coat made his way down the long, narrow sidewalk. As the man hurried between the row of parked cars and the tall apartment buildings, the girl tracked Ian's progress along the block with an attentiveness and intensity atypical of children so young. Hurrying along the street, Ian's anxiety gradually faded. "I'm being foolish. Dr. Henderson's theories were delusions of paranoia, despite anything my statistical analysis may have shown. His death was just an accident, that's all. Just an accident. Just because he was paranoid is no reason that I should be." Ian turned right at the end of the block and hurriedly crossed the street, scanning left and right for cars. As Ian continued to reassure himself that nothing was amiss and disappeared from view down the side street, the little girl in the upstairs apartment behind him returned to her cartoon show, and another little boy sitting high on the steps of his own apartment building further down the street stopped playing with his dog and directed his gaze toward Ian as he approached along the sidewalk. The puppy nudged the child's hand, demanding attention, but the boy ignored the pet and stared unerringly at Ian as he passed. "My only obligation," thought Ian, "is to take Dr. Henderson's papers and notes to his publisher, Stan Bergman. When that's done, my involvement with this whole affair will be over, and I can forget all of Henderson's outlandish claims." Yes, it would be best to forget the whole thing. He gulped, but found his mouth too dry to swallow. "If I can." After navigating his way the 6 city blocks from the public library to Stan Bergman's offices, Ian trotted up the steps of the publisher's building and dashed into a nearby empty elevator. Dr. Henderson had contacted Stan before his death and made tentative arrangements to have his papers published. He had even made Ian promise to deliver them if anything suspicious happened, such as his unexpected death. Laughing, Ian had agreed. Now he regretted making the promise and fought once more to stifle the doubts and worries Dr. Henderson's claims nurtured. Ian turned around to face the elevator doors, and as they closed, noticed a small boy sitting on a bench across the wide lobby. Waiting next to his mother, who was digging through her purse, the child's eyes seemed locked on Ian with a steady, unwavering stare. Ian felt a pang of uneasiness as the doors quickly closed. Shaking his head, Ian dismissed the coincidence. He reached over and punched the elevator button, wondered if he was imagining children watching him or whether it was just Dr. Henderson's bizarre theory, which made him suspicious. Ian's heart pounded in his chest as the doors of the elevator opened, and he stepped out into the hallway and hurried to Suite 414. As he approached the door, he heard the high-pitched laughter of children and abruptly slowed his pace. Walking slowly past the open door of a doctor's office in Suite 410, he saw a waiting room full of young boys and girls. He paused just long enough to note that the physician was a pediatrician and admonished himself that it was normal for all these children to be there. Quickening his pace, he passed the remaining offices and paused at the door, which bore a sign declaring Suite 414, Bergman Publishing. He inhaled and exhaled a few times to calm himself and glanced back over his shoulder. No one was in sight, but he still heard the giggling of children as they played back down the hall. Composing himself, he opened the door and walked into a small reception room. The anteroom was long and narrow, with a row of mismatched chairs along one wall which ended at a desk where a solitary secretary worked on a disorganized pile of papers. Raising her eyes to Ian, she cast an annoying glare and said, "Yes? Do you have an appointment?"
Yes, he replied, checking his watch. "I have a 10 o'clock meeting scheduled with Stan Bergman. I'm Ian McDonald."
The gray-haired secretary scowled, saying, "You're late. He's expecting you. Go on in." Then she returned to her work and began thumbing through the tall stack of papers that lay before her. Approaching the office door beyond the secretary's desk, Ian pushed it open and peeked in. Inside, he found a balding, heavyset man who was sitting at a desk and reading something so intently that he was oblivious to Ian's entrance. Stepping through the doorway, Ian entered the publisher's private office and waited patiently. The room smelled of stale smoke and dusty books. The office walls were lined with shelves and overloaded with books that lay in every orientation, stuffed and wedged into every crack and crevice. Except for the windows, everywhere Ian looked ended in rows and stacks of books. Piles of hardbounds rose from the floor in precariously balanced stacks and formed makeshift barriers in front of the more orderly bookshelves beyond. Boxes of paperbacks and thick paper manuscripts filled what little space remained in the large cluttered room. Small, ineffective lights glowed dimly from the vaulted ceiling high above, and the room was illuminated almost entirely by the light from the 3 tall glass windows,
behind the publisher's desk. Realizing that his presence remained unnoticed, Ian coughed softly to announce himself. The man behind the desk looked up and immediately brandished a large, gregarious smile.
"You must be Ian," he said, rising and offering his hand.
"Ben Henderson told me you'd be coming. Please, have a seat."
Stan Bergman gestured at a chair in front of the desk. The dark green cushion on the wooden chair was thick but worn. The other two chairs nearby were piled with stacks of manuscripts that threatened to spill onto the floor. Ian carefully huddled his own papers in one arm and extended his other hand to shake Stan's. The publisher's grip was strong and firm. Returning to his seat, Stan said,
"So, where is Ben? Couldn't he make it?"
Ian sat and paused for a moment. "I'm sorry," he said, lowering his eyes in embarrassment. "I guess I should have called ahead to explain. Dr. Henderson died the day before yesterday in an accident. He'd already set up this meeting and asked me to attend if he could not. One of the dean's secretaries has been making calls to notify Dr. Henderson's colleagues. I had assumed you'd been informed."
Stan's face grew dim. His eyebrows furrowed, and he stared down at his desk for a moment. Grinding his teeth in thought, he looked up and asked,
"I'm sorry to hear this. It's terrible. How did he die?"
Ian shrugged helplessly and said, "He fell down some stairs outside his apartment late Tuesday night. No one heard him fall. A neighbor found his body at the bottom of the stairwell the next morning."
Stan shook his head solemnly. "How tragic," he said. "Ben was a brilliant man. I'd known him for decades and published many of his books."
Wincing slightly, Ian nodded. "Dr. Henderson's last wish was for me to deliver this to you. He said you'd know whether or not to publish it." Placing his precious cargo of notes and documents on Stan's desk, Ian pushed the stack toward him.
"What's this all about?" asked Stan, tapping the pile.
"Didn't he tell you?" asked Ian. "He spoke as if you would know all about it." Stan shrugged slightly.
"I only knew it was based on some of his previous work on abnormal psychology. Ben didn't go into any details. He said he had to verify his findings first."
Ian's lips tightened. "That was my job," he said. "I was one of Dr. Henderson's doctoral candidates at the university. As my advisor, he got me a job a few months ago doing some statistical analysis on his research. It only paid part-time, but it was quite an honor to work with someone of his prestige." Pausing, Ian hesitated before continuing, struggling momentarily to figure out how much to explain. "Dr. Henderson's most recent research focused on anomalous psychological disorders. In his 20 years as head of the Department of Clinical Psychology at New York University, Dr. Henderson noticed a pattern in some of his clinical subjects. At first, he thought it was a fluke, but later he decided that he'd found a previously unsuspected form of paranoia. That's when he called me in to analyze his data. He was very excited about it."
"Really?" said Stan. "What would be so special?"
"Well," said Ian, "Dr. Henderson thought he'd found an odd form of paranoid schizophrenia in which patients' fears came true. In this rare form of paranoia, all the subjects thought that others were trying to kill them, and surprisingly, they all died."
"What do you mean?" said Stan, his eyebrows furrowing with curiosity.
"Dr. Henderson thought some patients classified as paranoids were incorrectly diagnosed. He had me analyze thousands of case studies from all over the world to validate his hypothesis, and his hunch appeared to be right. I found a subset of documented cases with an unusual pattern. All these patients were afraid of children and were convinced they were being watched. Remarkably, every patient diagnosed with this condition mysteriously died within 4 weeks of being diagnosed."
Stan looked doubtful for the first time. "That is odd. But couldn't that just be a coincidence?" he asked.
"That's what Dr. Henderson worried about,"
said Ian. That's why he had me do additional research, to find out if this pattern was a fluke, or whether it could be found in historical cases as well.
And what did you find?
Well, muttered Ian, I did find some similar patterns in clinical records dating back to the early 1920s. Looking back further, I even found similar references in 19th century Europe. Eventually, I even found this. Ian reached down to the papers he had placed on Stan's desk and pulled out a folder containing photocopies he had made earlier that day. Opening it, he showed Stan an image of an illuminated manuscript written in medieval Italian. This is the work of an excommunicated monk named Giuseppe di Orvani, entitled Uno Trattato su coloro che guarda, A Treatise on Those Who Watch, written in 1425. The author was a doctor of the church, who went quite mad. The cleric had abandoned his Catholic beliefs and declared that the earth was actually hell. It seemed he believed in demons, but not in angels. The demons in charge of this realm, he said, existed solely for the purpose of tormenting and terrorizing mankind. Moreover, he claimed that they watch us through the eyes of children. Stan's eyebrows rose in curiosity. Giovanni's is the first documented case of this rare form of paranoia that I could find. Also, in keeping with the pattern Dr. Henderson found, the mad cleric locked himself in a tower to keep children away, but fell to his death a mere week after publishing his treaty. The official report on his death concluded that he threw himself out of one of the windows in his tower, but a few others believed he was thrown out by the demons. When Ian paused, Stan asked, So, did Ben Henderson actually believe in these demons? Oh, no, said Ian. He thought this strange form of paranoia was a precursor for bouts of depression that eventually led to suicide. Dr. Henderson hoped that proper diagnosis might save lives of patients who might otherwise kill themselves. He didn't seriously consider that part about demons and children at least until near the end.
What do you mean? Asked Stan.
Ian shuffled in his seat uncomfortably. Well, about a week ago, Dr. Henderson started acting strangely. He claimed that children were indeed watching him, and that they weren't acting like children should. As his own paranoia increased, he eventually locked himself in his own apartment and refused to leave. It was as if he'd become infected with the same psychosis that he'd been studying.
I didn't think delusions like that were contagious. You can't spread mental disorders that way. Can you?
Ian waved his hand dismissively.
No, that's absurd. I just figured it was the stress of all his research that was getting to him.
You have to understand that he spent an incredible amount of work and time on this research. I figure he must have spent thousands of hours digging through case histories of hundreds of hospitals and clinics to discover this pattern. I really only did the mathematical analysis that showed the trends were statistically significant. At the end, I simply assumed all the work was getting to him. I didn't take his claims seriously. At least, I didn't. Until he died.
Stan's head tilted in a gesture of mild amazement. You mean, you think his claims about demons watching him through the eyes of children are valid?
Ian squirmed in his seat.
I don't know. Of course, it's ridiculous, but Dr. Henderson wasn't the type to commit suicide, and his death is just too much of a coincidence. My studies showed that there was indeed a pattern of people who fear children which result in death. To be honest, I've recently found myself watching children to see if they're watching me. He smiled meekly, as if making light of the idea, but his grin showed more stress and fear than mirth. Stan's curiosity turned to a dark concern.
You're taking Dr. Henderson's death pretty hard, aren't you?
Lowering his eyes, Ian nodded silently. His worried fingers wove themselves into knotted fists, and he said,
Yes, I guess so.
I just don't know what to think. At first, I thought Dr. Henderson's ideas were crazy. Later, I wondered that he might be delusional himself. Now, I'm wondering if I'm not imagining things. It doesn't make sense, does it, Mr. Bergman? It couldn't really be true, could it?
Stan rose and walked over to Ian, placing a firm hand on the scholar's shoulder.
No, he said. It's like Ben originally suggested. I'm sure there's a logical explanation. This form of delusion results in suicide, and probably has some real merit, especially if Ben thought it was so important. Tell you what, why don't I look over his findings and have others examine the results as well? You just go home and stop worrying. You're wound up so tight you're ready to snap. Why, you're shaking like a leaf!
Ian clenched his hands tightly to stop their trembling, but realized his whole body was shaking with terror.
I'm just tired, he said, lying. I haven't gotten much sleep since Dr. Henderson died.
Rising unsteadily, he held out his hand to Stan and said,
It's been a pleasure meeting you, sir. I'm sorry it was under such unpleasant circumstances.
Nodding and smiling politely, Stan shook Ian's hand and followed him to the office door.
I'll read over Ben's material and contact you in a few days, he said with fatherly reassurance.
Ian thanked Stan and nodded at the secretary in the outer beyond as he hurried out into the hallway. All Ian wanted was for all of this to be behind him. He didn't want to think about it anymore. As he strode down the hall toward the elevator, his pace quickened as he passed the pediatrician's office. However, as he reached the office door, a small boy no more than 6 or 7 suddenly stepped out and blocked his path. Ian lurched to a halt, almost running into the child. But the boy seemed unconcerned. Looking up at him, the child said,
You shouldn't have noticed us.
Ian stood in stunned silence.
The boy stood arrogantly before him, with a poise quite unlike anything Ian had seen before in a child so young.
You see, now we've noticed you as well.
The child's eyes flicked over to the office door Ian had just left.
And of course, we've noticed him too.
Ian glanced back behind him and realized the boy was referring to Stan. The boy was actually threatening both of them. Anger welled up in Ian, washing away the chill of fear that had crept into him over the past few days. Losing control momentarily, Ian turned back to the boy and grabbed him by both shoulders. Shaking the boy, he shouted,
Who are you? What do you mean? How do you know these things?
This story is continued in the next episode.